Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leader in obesity medicine.
I recently gave a lecture to the second-year students at Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine that consisted of a complex case study of a patient with obesity that had multiple medical factors contributing to her weight. It was the first time I had done a case study of this nature, and to make the case more compelling for the students, I had the patient present her experience with healthcare both before and during her time with me. I would present some aspect of her case, and she would relate her perceptions regarding that condition. At one point, we got to a very difficult moment in her care. After a year and a half of various treatments with limited success, she opened up to me about having a binge eating disorder. She was very reluctant to tell me this earlier because she was convinced that I would either blame all her problems on her eating disorder or send her for counseling and stop seeing her as a patient. I didn't do either, but what struck me was what she told the class. She said she didn't remember what I said, but she remembered how I made her feel, that I did not make her feel ashamed or judge, but instead took the information and applied it to a new treatment strategy. As healthcare providers, our words are impactful, and what we say is important, but even more important is how our patients translate those words into feelings. It's those feelings that have a lasting effect on our patients, which can inspire and promote healthy change or deflate and demote patients, worsening their struggle. Hi, I'm Dr. Nick Pennings, Chair of Family Medicine at the Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine and Executive Director of Clinical Education for the Obesity Medicine Association. And with me today is Ted Kyle, registered pharmacist, MBA. He's a noted blogger and is a well-known, powerful voice and contributor to advancing policy and public opinion for the fair treatment of people with obesity. Tell us more about yourself, Ted.
Sure. If I'm thinking correctly, I'm remembering that Campbell University is in Eastern North Carolina. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So I actually went to high school not far from Campbell University.
Oh, really?
In Goldsboro, North Carolina.
Okay, yes.
First worked in a pharmacy there in Goldsboro, went to pharmacy school, and through a long series of events, became a pharmacist and an advocate for people living with obesity. And this is a very personal issue for me. I live with the health effects of obesity. It's something that affects my family. It's something that affects many, many friends that I have to more or less serious degrees. And I look at the situation, and I've been working on this for more than two decades. And even today, I see so much room for progress, despite the fact that we've seen a lot of progress. And that's really what motivates me to keep working on this every single day.
And I think we've all been touched by obesity, whether if it's not personal, then within our families and friends and peers. And as clinicians, we also certainly see it in our practice. And one of the challenges around obesity is stigma and bias. And I think we've made progress in addressing many areas of bias with race and gender, sexual preference, age, but bias towards people with obesity seems to be as strong as ever. Why do you think that is so? And do you see it changing anytime soon?
Well, so in the time that I've been working on this, I have seen change. And I've seen this reflected in data out of the Harvard Implicit Project, where they track both explicit and implicit bias against many different dimensions. And honestly, their data shows that explicit bias about obesity has become less common. And this reflects what I see out there in the real world, where it's not okay to express nasty things about people with obesity and really express that explicit bias. But oddly enough, in their data, you know, since 20, 2007, they have seen implicit bias rise and then stay fairly stable at a high level. And this is different from just about every other form of bias that they track. It is embedded in our understanding of obesity in subtle and pervasive ways. And that's why the implicit bias has not really changed. I do see hope for progress because the understanding of obesity as a physiologic condition and not a condition of choice or behavior or lifestyle is becoming more common, and the science is catching up with us. And as we have drugs that are more effective in treating obesity, it makes people realize, oh, so this is like other diseases where if you treat them, they get better.
And I think two things there. One, maybe just explain the difference between implicit and explicit bias for our listeners. And two, how does that change in perception around understanding obesity as a disease, as we are now have more therapeutic interventions, impact explicit versus implicit bias?
So as an example of explicit bias, I think of an editorial that was published in the American Journal of Medicine back in 2015, where a cardiologist said, what we need is to have frank talks with our patients and tell them, look, this is your responsibility to shape up and lose weight. You weigh too much because you eat too much. And it's as simple as that. And that is an expression of explicit bias because it does not reflect the true nature of obesity and the physiologic drivers of obesity. It has, in that case, a physician modeling a behavior of telling a person that it isn't their fault and up to them to do something about it. And that kind of explicit bias that is spoken outright is no longer acceptable. The implicit bias would be comes in many, many different forms, but it's the kind of bias that affects our choices and our behaviors without us really consciously thinking about it. For example, for a long time, the American Heart Association classified blood pressure as a biometric indicator of health, for example. But it looked at measures of adiposity as a measure of behavior, as a measure of lifestyle. Now, they weren't saying we think these people are awful. They were just saying that this is directly just this physiologic condition of obesity is a measure of how a person is living and the choices that they are making. And that influenced a lot of things that the American Heart Association did with respect to obesity. But when the Heart Association went from a paradigm of life's simple seven, classifying obesity as a behavior, to life's essential eight, they moved obesity from a behavior to a biological sign. And that really kind of perfectly illustrates how implicit bias can crop up.
Well, thank you. I think that's a great explanation. You brought up how physicians talk to their patients. And I remember a physician once complaining to me about a patient who had not lost any weight in spite of him telling her to do so, saying, I just haven't been firm enough with her. I really have to lay it on her next time and be firm about it. Another experience, a patient that had gained more weight said, the physician said, quote, I guess it's time to have the talk. Meaning that he was going to tell the patient how bad obesity was for their health. What do you think about those approaches in discussing a patient's weight?
The simplest thing I can say is that it reflects a lack of empathy, a lack of understanding about the lived experience of those patients that they're talking about. And I've found that a lot of times we assume that patients don't understand, that people living with obesity don't understand that obesity is a problem. Trust me, they do. But in any situation where you want to persuade somebody of something, one of the classic constructions of formulating that dialogue is one of problem solution. The problem side of the formula in the case of obesity is very well established in the minds of of a person with obesity. They have had perhaps a lifetime of people telling them that it's a problem, either subtly or not so subtly. The question has been, what can I do about it? And if you confront people with a problem and don't offer them good solutions, well, the natural human defense is to say, you know what? I'm going to worry about problems I can do something about. I am not going to obsess about a problem that I can do nothing about. And when you tell someone who has lived a lifetime with obesity that they need to lose weight, and they've spent their life trying to lose weight through diet and exercise, and finding that that wasn't adequate for solving their problem, they say, you're really not talking to me, doc.
Right. And I think implicit in that is the idea that obesity is a choice, and that patient is just making a bad choice, and you just have to tell them to make a better choice. And of course, we know that obesity is not a choice.
Couldn't agree more. And I have many friends. Everybody's experience with obesity is different, but many, many people I know have lived with obesity from the very earliest days of their lives. They did not, as a 2-year-old, decide, hey, I want to go down this path for life. They inherited a gene pool and social circumstances that put them on that path.
Right. And so when they're hearing those kind of messages, what is the patient response?
Well, it can vary all over the place. I mean, everybody's experience is different, but the natural human response to an intractable problem is to get to a place where they say that it's there's no point. I can't do anything about this. This is my fault. And often that bias that is directed at them becomes internalized. And people say, and I've heard people tell me this in depth interviews and focus groups, there's something wrong with me. I just am not good enough to deal with this. And actually, that kind of internalized bias predicts worse outcomes clinically.
Right. Increases stress levels. And then as people become more stressed, they go to their coping mechanisms for stress, right? Which may be food for some people.
Absolutely right.
Another thing that patients will relate to me are some of the terms that physicians have used with them in the past, or other clinicians have used them in the past, calling them fat or obese or even morbidly obese. How do terms like that impact patient care? And what's a better way to discuss weight with patients?
Well, you know, I look at the language that we use around obesity, and particularly the labels that we give people, as an important way of framing obesity, as really sort of a clue to or a tell to how you are thinking about them. If you call someone obese, or even worse, morbidly obese, which is an archaic term that people don't really use anymore or shouldn't use anymore, you are signaling to them that you are thinking of them as nothing more than their health condition, as not really a whole human being with the respect that a human being deserves. I believe strongly that it's important to separate the condition that you're trying to help somebody with from a person's identity. And it's very important that the words that you use reflect your respect for that individual.
And going back to that story that I told in the beginning, you know, those are the kind of words that really are going to create a very negative feeling for patients. And those are the things that they're going to remember as a result of that conversation. And so being very careful with the choice of our words and avoiding labeling and showing judgment towards the patient are really, I think, important part of patient care.
It really is. And it tells a patient in unspoken ways whether or not they can trust you, whether or not you have their respect, or perhaps you someone who uses language that is dismissive. It says, well, I am not going to be regarded for my needs, but rather for who they think I am.
Yeah. So obesity is recognized as a disease by a wide number of medical organizations, and yet not everyone recognizes that, including some of our patients. healthcare providers want to see patients improve their health, and treating obesity is considered a path to improvement of many diseases. How should healthcare professionals, though, address a patient who doesn't want to pursue obesity treatment, even though they have a number of obesity-related diseases?
I think what's important here is to understand what a person's goal for health is and what their lived experience with obesity has been. It's really essential to pay attention to a very basic principle of medical ethics, which is respect for patient autonomy. And why it's so important with obesity is because people come into a patient care situation with a lifetime of often very harsh experiences with obesity. And it may be that some of the mental health aspects of obesity are a more urgent concern for that patient than engaging in active weight loss or goals that, you know, when you first meet a person without actually talking to them about what their personal goals are, might seem to, you know, an arm's length observer to be an important need. And that's a function of the way obesity is treated. Social systems come into play so much, including health systems, that discourage a patient from getting care. And the social systems that make, for example, intensive behavioral care very difficult for some patients. And so it's really, really essential to realize that one size doesn't fit all in terms of how one might approach obesity.
I also find that it takes a lot of energy to be able to work on managing your weight, that to make dietary changes, to engage in regular physical activity, to make behavioral changes, all these lifestyle components, improving sleep habits, take a lot of effort on the part of the patient. And some patients just don't have the bandwidth to deal with it at that time. I've had times when I've told patients, look, you got to back off on worrying about your weight. You know, let's focus on, you know, your spouse's illness or getting through some of these financial challenges that you're having or some other family issues. And then we can talk more about how to address weight issues. But I think we need to respect the amount of time and energy that it takes to address lifestyle changes, and that we have to be understanding of our patient's capacity to do that.
And something I hear from both patients and providers alike is that with the advent of better physiologic treatment for obesity, the burden that a patient faces in terms of making behavioral changes becomes lighter when they have help with the physiology that's not really working. One thing that you hear from people with obesity a lot these days is that when a patient gets really effective obesity treatment, some of the food noise, some of the preoccupation with food that takes up a lot of mental space for them before treatment is gone away, or at least at a very low level, and it makes their ability to cope and the energy that has to go into coping much different.
Yeah, you know, there's so many situations where we are tempted with food, we live in an obesogenic environment where food stimuli are everywhere, whether it be on commercials, driving by fast food, the break room at work, social gatherings where food is there. There's a lot of temptation around food, a lot of opportunities to eat. And very often, those foods are not the healthiest food choices to make. And if you're hungry and you're in that environment, it's really hard to say no compared to if you're not hungry or if you don't have that food chatter in your head. And I think that really has made a big positive impact on management of obesity in patients.
Absolutely right.
So another challenging situation is talking to kids about weight. It's such a sensitive topic for them. How should clinicians approach the discussion of obesity with kids? Is it different from adults? Is it similar? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it is very different. It's one simple reason that it's different is that there is another person involved in this clinical situation, and that is the parent. And the parent comes in with a certain burden when they have a child that is suffering with obesity or with severe obesity, and that burden has to do with the blame and guilt that they often bring into the relationship. And then somehow that can easily get transferred to the child, and it becomes a very fraught issue. Working with a lot of folks who are both advocates for youth with obesity and who are care providers with obesity, one of the critical conversations that takes place in a situation where people are getting really good medical care for pediatric obesity is the understanding that this really is a disease, a health condition, that it is not the fault of either the parent or the child. That is a huge hurdle to get past. And releasing that guilt, whether it's the parent's guilt or the child's guilt or a little bit of both, it is critically, critically important. And then it's important to meet people really where they are, to have honest conversations about the health condition that they face, a health condition that is not their fault any more than asthma or any other health condition that a child might face, but one that a provider stands ready to help with. And then going into offering the help, including referral to centers that can provide intensive care for children who are severely affected by obesity.
I think those are some great points, and it's so important that we address this issue as it is continuing to be a large problem, not just for today, but for the future, as the epigenetics of obesity become a factor in future generations. So it is important. And also the earlier that obesity is occurs in an individual, the greater their long-term health risks. So I think it's really important that we address these issues.
Absolutely. It used to be that the presumption was that children might grow out of it and that treatment should be reserved for kids living with obesity once they progress into late adolescence and adulthood. And the recent guidelines from the American Academy of Pediatrics says, you know, this was really flawed thinking. The truth is that what you're doing, especially for kids with severe obesity, is letting complications of that progress and making it more resistant to treatment. But then the folks who are actually giving good treatment for pediatric obesity are finding that they have much more power, much more room to improve a child's clinical outlook.
That's great. Well, this has been a wonderful discussion. I'd like to ask you one other thing is, what is your favorite piece of advice for clinicians on how to talk to patients about obesity?
I guess my favorite piece of advice came from Gary Foster, who is a clinical psychologist. And early when I was working on this, one of the sound bites that I've just retained from him is, if you're talking to a patient about obesity and you're doing half the talking, you're talking too much. And what that adds up to is you really, really need to listen to people and meet them where they are, especially because the history of it makes it such a fraught subject. You never know what somebody's lived experience has been. You might encounter a patient with a BMI of 35, and until you have a really good conversation with them, not know that actually this is the healthiest weight that they've ever experienced, and they've been working on it for years to get to that point.
I think that's great advice. I find the more I listen, the better I can guide patients. And I think that's a really important component. So, Ted, where can people find out more about your work?
Well, so at consciencehealth.org, CONSCIENHEALTH, I publish a commentary every day and get lots of feedback from lots of people all over the world, and it's very satisfying. It also helps me keep up with what's going on. And then I would also recommend that people check out obesityaction.org. This is the really the only and the, you know, and certainly the largest organization devoted to education, advocacy, and elevation of the voices of people living with obesity. It's a nonprofit. I served on the National Board of Directors for a dozen years and served as its chair, and still serve as an emeritus board member. Really elevating that voice of people with obesity is essential to guiding us toward better approaches to obesity.
That's great. And you also presented at the 2023 Spring Obesity Summit Conference in New York City, lecture titled "The Power of Putting People First, The Importance of the Language We Use." You can find this presentation in the OMA Academy. And if you like this podcast, Obesity, a Disease, please share it with a friend or colleague. Thanks for being with me today, Ted.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Obesity, a Disease. For more information about obesity medicine podcasts and other valuable resources from the clinical leaders in obesity medicine, please visit www.obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode and want to listen regularly, head over to iTunes where you can subscribe, rate, and leave us a much appreciated review. The views expressed in this episode are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please join us again for our next episode of Obesity, a Disease.